Now, I'm a married man, and still am, and I have a dear wife, Belita. And it was 1978, and it's November now, and I'm reading The Hobbit. And I was becoming very restless. And I said to Belita, I need to take a walk. And she said, fine, Kevin, we're not going to eat for another hour or two. And I said, no, Belita, I really need to take a walk. And my idea was to walk Ireland, you know, as much of it as I could, and come home and maybe someday write an Irish children's story. Ireland's Heidi. That's what was in my mind. But I did not know I was going to walk the donkey when I got there.
That's Kevin O'Hara, author of Last of the Donkey Pilgrims. And this is Writer's Voice. Hi, I'm Francesca Rhiannon, your host for Writer's Voice on Valley Free Radio. My WMUA co-host Daisy Mathias and I spoke with Kevin O'Hara in honor of St. Patrick's Day, and we'll spend most of this hour with him. But first, we'll hear an excerpt from an archived interview with Michael Clare about his book, Blood and Oil. Writer's Voice spoke to Clare on Election Day 2004, and his book is as timely now as it was then. Clare spoke about the end of oil, the economic crisis that will ensue, and continuing global conflict over resources. You know, I'm going to ask what may sound like a Luddite question, but given the problem with global warming as a result of our burning of fossil fuels like petroleum, would it be all that bad a thing if we did have this severe economic downturn, wouldn't that mean less global warming? Wouldn't that mean perhaps a possibility to save the planet, to put the push on alternative forms of energy, or not?
You know, all of this is going to come to pass. That is to say, there will be a time when petroleum will be scarce, when SUVs will be uneconomical to drive, when a lot of the things that we're accustomed to do now, to drive everywhere, probably won't be practical, and we'll be forced to make changes that are going to be hard for some of us, switching from private automobiles to public transportation or to bicycles or whatever, you know, alternatives come about. The question is whether we'll be ready at that time with new forms of technology, wind power, solar power, hydrogen, that will make this transition relatively easy to bear. In other words, we'll go from something that's dying to something that's new and growing and not feel terrible pain in the process. And that's the big worry here, is that we're not making the investment and the effort to develop the alternatives that we're going to need so that they'll be ready in time when we need them. This is the big, big worry here, that the Bush-Cheney energy plan, by postponing the development of alternative technologies, means they won't be ready when we really need them. So there may be a dark ages that we're looking forward to, you know, 10 or 20 or 30 years out, when there's not much oil, fossil fuel energy, or natural gas, but the new hydrogen technology, if that's what it's going to be, or fusion power or solar power, is not ready on a scale large enough to make up the difference.
Yeah, a literal dark ages, I suppose.
Literal dark ages.
Well, one of the things you talk about is also the the consequence in terms of global conflict. And, you know, the conventional wisdom is that the 21st century will be one of local ethnic conflicts, of many small wars. But one of the scariest possibilities you talked about, at least for me, was the reappearance of big power conflicts, especially mm-hmm. between the U.S., China, and Russia.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if you could explain that.
Well, the United States is not alone in having an economy that's very dependent on imports. The other large economy, well, several, Europe and Japan, are also dependent on imports to a considerable degree, and they rely on the Middle East. And they more or less have bought into the Carter Doctrine policy of using military force by the United States to protect their access to the oil of the Middle East. So that's been the prevailing system for quite some time. But now you have a new entrant into this competition for oil, and that's China. China has the fastest growing economy in the world. It has the largest population in the world. It has a rising middle class with an appetite for automobiles and other intensively energy intensive commodities and appliances and the like. So China now needs a large supply of imported oil, but it looks at an area, the Persian Gulf, that's heavily dominated by the United States. So China is seeking to gain access to other areas where there might be oil, Africa and the Caspian Sea, Central Asia region. But as I indicated, the United States also seeks additional oil from these areas because of our growing demand. So you have an intensifying competition for oil on a global scale between the U.S., Europe, Japan, and China. And the U.S. and China don't share the same cooperative structure that the U.S. and Japan and the U.S. and Europe do. So there is a risk that this competition will get ugly. And what worries me so much is that both the U.S. and China are militarizing their foreign oil policy, by which I mean the U.S., well, U.S. historically has sent its troops and its guns where its oil comes from in the Middle East. We form alliances with local leaders and kings and dictators and provide them with weapons and military support. But China is beginning to copy our pattern by forming military alliances of its own with its foreign oil suppliers like Sudan and Iran. And so you have a competitive pursuit of military alliances in areas of interest because of oil. And this I find to be very dangerous. I'm not saying that the U.S. and China are preparing to go to war with one another. I find that very hard to believe that either of them would view this as an intentional matter of policy. But they are providing arms and military advisors to competing to local rivals in these areas. And that is worrisome because it stirs up local arms races and could lead to a local conflict that escalates and unintentionally brings in the great powers into a larger war. This is the way World War I began.
Right, I was just going to say that sounds like the Balkans.
It's exactly the way the Balkans were before World War I, when France and Britain and the Austro-Hungarian Empire and the Russian Empire were all competing for influence in the Balkan area, all providing arms and assistance and treaties and the like. And thus, when a spark was when a match was lit, the whole place blew up and World War I began. I worry that this could happen in the Persian Gulf or the Caspian Sea area because it's a very similar pattern underway.
Yeah, and also the other aspect of it is it seems to be in this positive feedback loop with this whole arms trade.
Yes, well, that's what I was alluding to, is a competitive arms race fueled by arms sales or arms deliveries to the countries in the area. You know, an example is Sudan, where China is providing the Sudanese government with weapons and military advice that the Sudanese government is using against rebel forces in the south, the Sudanese People's Liberation Army, the SPLA. And human rights observers have claimed that these Chinese-supplied weapons have been used for scorched earth policies and ethnic cleansing on a very large and bloody and lethal scale. So that's just one instance of how all of this leads to very ugly repercussions.
Right. I want to go back to something you said before about the price of oil.
Mm-hmm.
Bush has presided over the creation of the biggest deficit in history, wiping out, of course, the surplus that was that developed under Clinton. And this is also the first time in U.S. history that taxes have been cut during a time of war. And the price of oil is approaching historic levels. I wonder, what are the implications for the long-term growth of our national debt of these price rises?
From my perspective, it's a very worrisome development. I read the business pages of the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times and The Economist, and you hear statements from very conservative economists saying, this is not good. This is very dangerous. This is unsustainable. You can't go on spending money and lowering taxes and borrowing from foreign governments without there eventually being a price to pay. And talk of a crash somewhere down the line. I'm not enough of an economist to be able to say when this might occur, how this might occur, but I certainly see signs that this is a very worrisome development.
And with doesn't the price of oil, if it's high, doesn't that increase our national debt? I mean, particularly the U.S. is paying?
Absolutely, yeah. because we import so much of our oil, it's the imports that are rising, and more money, dollars, that means, are flowing to the oil providers, especially to the Middle Eastern countries, but also to the African countries and Latin American countries. So we're seeing a net loss of dollars. Let me add that, you might say, well, this is good for the people in Africa and Latin America, right? Mm-hmm. Because the dollars are flowing there. But typically it doesn't work out that way. What typically happens is that elites and kings and military leaders in those countries monopolize the flow of dollars and give it to their cronies and put it in Swiss bank accounts and that sort of thing. So very little of this money trickles down to the poor people that inhabit these countries. And this, in fact, is a source of a great deal of instability. In Nigeria, for example, where there's a lot of unrest right now and violence in the oil fields, which has contributed to the slowdown in oil production and high prices, this is occurring because all of the oil revenues are flowing to the elites in the capital of Abuja, and none of it is coming to the people, the minorities, the tribal groups in the Niger Delta region where the oil is produced. So those people are up in arms and are protesting the central government, and they're attacking the oil companies and blowing up pipelines. And this shows how oil itself is a source of instability in the developing world.
Yeah, it's also contributed to a fair amount of ecological destruction of their own land so that they're unable to fish and really make their own livelihood.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and just to make a final connecting of the dots there, I mean, from what I understand, a country like China owns a fair amount of our national debt, and so if they are rivals with us for oil, could they, could they cash in, basically, and force us into a certain position where we have to pay on our loans, and they would really be top dog when it came to access to oil there?
Well, this is something that people speculate about, and when they speculate, it looks very nightmarish. I just can't be sure how all of this will play itself out in the years ahead. I mean, everybody in the world has a vested interest in the whole system hanging together.
Mm-hmm.
China and Japan and Russia and everybody else have now bought into the world market system, and the principal engine of that system is consumer spending in the United States. So if you pull the plug on American consumer spending, the whole world economy is going to cave in. So there are a lot of reasons why other countries may be averse to taking that risk. But everybody agrees that it can't go on like this forever, that something has got to give, and eventually there will be a price to be paid.
That's Michael Clare, Hampshire College professor and author of several books about scarce resources and global conflict. You're listening to Writer's Voice on Valley Free Radio. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Now, in a lighter note, we have an interview that Daisy Mathias and I did with Kevin O'Hara, author of the memoir Last of the Donkey Pilgrims. In the 1970s, O'Hara returned to Western Massachusetts, where he lives, from the war in Vietnam, feeling rootless. So he went to Ireland, his parents' homeland, in search of his roots. The journey began as a mad lark. Who in the world would circle the entire coastline of Ireland in a donkey cart? But along the way, he met a bevy of wonderful characters and made friends with one phenomenal donkey named Missy. O'Hara found what he came for and more besides.
Kevin O'Hara, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Well, thanks for having me.
Well, we wanted to talk to you about your book, Last of the Donkey Pilgrims, subtitled A Man's Journey Through Ireland. Can you tell us what a donkey pilgrim is?
Well, I wasn't quite sure myself until I was midway through the journey. The journey took 8 months, and it was 1,720 miles, and I walked alongside a little donkey named Missy back in 1979 when the roads in Ireland were very quiet. And midway through our journey, we were going through Dublin, which was always difficult for the donkey. All the cities were. And we stayed at Mount Argus Monastery with a beautiful green patch of field right in the middle of the suburbs. And there was a brother, Malachy Daly, and he says, "You're the last of the donkey pilgrims." And I asked the same question. And years, many years ago, and actually up into the 50s and 60s, farmers were using donkeys as opposed to horses, one, because of poverty, two, because of the penal laws that took place a century earlier where no Irishman could really own a horse of any great or true value. But the old women and men, especially in the West, truly believed in the curative powers of the holy wells, which were sprinkled everywhere along the West Coast and in the Midlands. But they would get onto a donkey's back, but it was the only way they could actually even travel there. But they'd get on a donkey's back and go to these wells praying for a cure, and that was a donkey pilgrim. And sometimes they'd have to go many, many miles to get to these places. And some of the holy wells, I mean, one holy well was for homesickness, which was very popular well in Donegal because so many people emigrated. Back in the 19th, early 20th century, when you lost a son and daughter to emigration, I mean, it was as if losing them. You would never see them again. And these elderly people left behind would pine, and they would go to these wells for comfort. There were also wells for toothaches, earaches, and many other maladies that hit all of us.
Well, you know, certainly in your book, you talk quite a bit about the tragedy as well as the wealth and the richness, the cultural richness of Ireland. Now, you were born in England of an Irish parent and then came to Massachusetts as a child and have been living in Western Mass and Pittsfield since then. Do you still maintain contact with your Irish family? What's your connection with the old country?
Yeah. Well, it became very strong, Francesca, in a funny kind of way. Both my parents were born in Roscommon and Longford, and they had five of us children in England. And my dad said to my mom, probably in 52, 53, "Let's move, let's emigrate to America so you and I don't feel our sons and daughters leaving us like we did our own families back in Ireland." So they sailed on the Queen Elizabeth and landed in New York with $220 in their pockets. And they moved up towards here because my mother has a sister, Nancy Carroll, who lives in Lenox. And that was our connection to the area where I am now in Pittsfield. But my mother never assimilated into this country at all. And after having the five of us in England, my mother and dad had three more children that we always called the Yanks. And they had them here. But my mother suffered very low periods during that time, and she really wanted to be home, either to Ireland or England. And we would feel her pain, and we would oftentimes get letters from her mother, my grandmother, and I was the lucky one to be able to start a little stamp collection. And she'd tell these wonderful stories about Ireland when I was 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 years of age, many days of which we actually stayed home from school to care for our mom because she suffered from postpartum depression. But at age 17, I was 17, my brother Dermot, 15, my parents finally saved enough money to take a return trip back to Ireland. This would have been 13 years since their arrival to America. And we were lucky ones, Dermot and I. And what hit me most was how my mother became a different person over there. She was nothing like the woman we knew. We knew her as Ellen, but everybody called her Lella. She had a great deal of Irish. She played a lovely melodeon and a harmonica, things that, you know, weren't evident to us. And years later, I had a year in Vietnam, and I returned very unsettled, and I knew that Ireland was the place to go to seek some solace. And I was always haunted by the emigration thing. What would I have been like if I had been able to live in Ireland? Would I have been a great man with the cattle or the horses, or all those questions? And I knew, I always felt I'd be a better person there than here, strictly maybe because of just the wonderful culture there, especially in the 60s and 70s. So it always, forever haunted me what Ireland was like.
Well, now, this journey took place in 1979. Why did you wait so long to write about it?
Oh, it was a tough go. I tell you, walking the donkey was one thing. It was, you know, putting words to a white sheet was something else for me. I mean, you never knew yourself as a writer, and nobody said it, and I never went to school for that. I'm a nurse. And I would tell many stories. I started bartending at La Casina here in Pittsfield shortly after my donkey travels, and I had all these stories to tell everybody, and people would say, write them down. Although I did keep a very good journal during my, you know, my go round. And I started writing annual St. Patrick's Day pieces for the Berkshire Eagle. And each one told me a little bit more of what I needed to do to be a better writer, and just how involved writing was, but how much I actually enjoyed it, especially the final draft after some 20 drafts before it. And this March 17th, it will be my 23rd annual St. Patrick's Day story in the Eagle, and my goal is 50 in a row. I'll be 84 years of age when it comes out, and I'll probably be eating green Jell-O at a nursing home. But it's something to shoot for, right?
Well, you know, you just did one piece once a year because you are a superb writer.
Oh, thanks. Well, during the whole little, you know, the writing for the Eagle, I was still writing the book on my donkey travels. I would just throw in little anecdotes to the Eagle and see how they flew.
And did you rework that 20
times? Oh,
very
much, very much so. And then I managed to get back to Ireland a few times in the meantime, and then I would polish up, you know, what I had maybe missed or lacked, you know, on my initial go. All in all, in certain ways, the only thing I'm sad about that it took 25 years to write is that I went to Ireland last, Belita and I, my wife, we went back to Ireland for a great celebration because it marked the 25th year of my return back to Radigan's Pub from where we started with the donkey. And I had just a cartload of books, well, a trunkload of books at this time, to give to all the wonderful people, and so many had already, you know, had already died. And I just missed some people by 1 or 2 years. Oh, you should have come by a year ago. Mary Clary was just talking about you. You know, so those things really bothered me.
You know, I'm sure it's a gift to their children as well.
Yeah.
Those
well,
I understand the sorrow, the sense of missing something, but, you know, I think those gifts are really important also. Mm-hmm. You know, I wanted to ask you, too, though, there's an awful lot of wonderful dialogue that's in the book, and you do say somewhere in the beginning that you reconstructed some of, you know, some, a lot of the dialogue is kind of made up from what you remember, you know, reconstructed somewhat from your journals. How did you reconstruct that dialogue?
You know, the journey comes back to you rather quickly because it was so, you know, different. It was almost like taking a walk around some of the rings of Saturn. You'd always remember it. And when I had an occasion to be in a pub or a pub scene, well, for the next 6, 7, 8 miles of road, it was all quiet, basically, except for Missy's hoofs ringing off the road. And you had a lot of time just to play with the language and hear them out. And I could always think well that way. I mean, in dialogue form, I mean, my dialogue was fine enough in the book, but it was those transitional paragraphs that would take me forever. You know, just give me a mouthpiece and an old man, and I could put something out with it, you know. It just came, and it was my father, I guess, Mom. I mean, they, you know, we always heard the chat, you know, and their chat was lovely and colorful. And I remember writing in my journal, you can write whatever you say because the language is so absolutely outlandish. And they never would use a cliche, the Irish. You'd go into a pub where one would kind of try to top the other in the way they could turn a phrase. And sometimes they say something that was just so special that you'd write it down on a beer coaster or a napkin, or you didn't have to write it at all because you knew you would never forget it.
The proverbial gift of gab, isn't
oh,
it?
Oh, boy, it just came splashing out at them, you know, whenever they will, at their whim. Even young children had it. And that's one of the great losses today. I was fortunate enough to meet tremendous people since the book has come out, including Matt Malloy of the Chieftains. And he loved a buck, and he said what he finds lost is the children now, or the kids who always twisted the language like licorice. Now, he says, they're just content in speaking the way you'd hear the stars on Friends, you know, on the television program talk, and it's all short and quippy and American-sounding.
Not with that flavor.
It's a great loss, especially from the wealth of language that the Irish did have.
Yeah. Yes, it doesn't have the same flavor and piquancy, does it?
No.
Yeah. Now, this is really two journeys, this book. There's an outer journey and an inner journey. And in the book, you are aware of the inner parallel to your odyssey. Tell us a little bit how those interwove for you.
The outside tangible journey of walking the roads where, you know, just what was and every day was different from the next. But the inner journey came, I suppose, slower, and it's something that I never really thought about except when you were out. And I think anybody who ever suffers from, oh, I don't know, a little depression or something, a great long walk will do the heart so well. And when it comes to the spirituality that I found, especially towards the end of the journey, I think it had a lot to do with having nothing, meeting generous people, and then just being outdoor where you could just look at the magnificence of the clouds, stars at night, the lovely hills, the smells. I mean, Ireland is the perfect place to go. I mean, if you want to be a saint or you have a vocation for the sainthood, I tell you, County Mayo's and Donegal are the places to go, just like the old anchorites in the Middle Ages.
That's Kevin O'Hara, author of Last of the Donkey Pilgrims. You're listening to Writer's Voice. You know, I wanted to kind of go back to what you were saying about the changes, because that was a theme that really came up quite a bit, and I also found very near and dear to my heart, because I spent a year in rural Provence where there was the same kind of sense of the preservation of old traditions. I mean, the French are very big on that, and especially they are in the rural areas. You know, I was really struck by how those old ways were preserved then and how committed the people were at the time. You know, there were so many comments that the European community, which is now, of course, the EU, you know, doesn't want a country of 10-acre farms, you say in the book. So I wonder if you could explain what you found there and what that meant.
Yeah. Well, you mean back then or presently?
Back then, and then we can go on to what's happening now.
Well, I thought it was a very ideal place to grow up and with families. And it was best for my journey, because I don't know if there would be another country where every so many miles of road, you could come upon a farmhouse for the donkey who always needed a field for the night to graze. And the 10-acre farms were absolutely perfect for me, because they were all small holdings, and people, although they struggled terrifically hard, they never seemed to show anything or concern themselves with it. About the whole transition, I think there's a great deal lost, and of course things gained, and what can you do, but progress comes rushing through at everybody, and Ireland may have been a very contented place in the 70s, but I saw it as that, but many people struggled with the same, you know, plates in front of them without much, you know, an old car that would go here to there. It's a sad little place when the weather isn't right in Ireland, and the houses were always kind of dusky and didn't show too much appearance. I could see how that day-by-day struggle would really get to you. But, you know, along with that, you know, they seem to have everything they want now, and I think they probably have less of what they once had.
Do you think that's inevitable? I mean, do you think there is a way to preserve what's good about the past without poverty?
Yeah, I was speaking to somebody there the other day who said that Dublin wouldn't seem to care too much about the old ways. And he told me, believe me, the old ways were very old. And Dublin, of course, is towards the east, and they're more, well, they're not certainly anglicized, but they're more European than the west. I think there'll be great holdings in the west, especially in the Irish-speaking Gaeltacht areas. But, again, there's money, and money is building holiday homes, and there's a great encroachment. And television and the Sky Channel, I think that's what's going to kill the culture quicker than anything else. I mean, there's not that many Irish speakers any longer, and if they're all watching the English programming, I watched a little nativity play in 79, which was all in Irish, and as soon as the children got off the stage, they were talking in English.
Yeah, and you were interviewed by an Irish language radio, and you were the first person they'd ever interviewed who spoke English.
I know, I was a real big shot that day.
Yeah, well tell us about that.
Well, there's three Irish areas, and they were some of the warmest areas to go through, and the first one was in Kerry, down around Dunquin on the Dingle Peninsula, and I was at Kruger Kavanaugh's pub in Dunquin, and Ger O'Savin, a wonderful man, asked if I would speak and be interviewed, but he had to get clearance first, because I was the first ever. And the reason he accepted it is because he thought the donkey travels were in the heart of the Irish tradition. And so it must have shocked all the natives the next day when he went through the interview with me. But they always helped because there were two other times when I got into these areas, Donegal and again in Connemara, and they would follow me and they would tell the listeners if they saw me walk by to ring the radio station, so they always kind of kept tabs on our travels. But it was great fun because, you'd end up in a pub that night at the end, and they more or less pinpointed exactly what pub you'd be at and what time you'd arrive, and there'd be 70 or 80 people there waiting to say hello to you and watch you drink a pint of Guinness.
That's great.
They test your mettle on how many pints you could drink, you know. But it was all very embarrassing, too. You know, because they used to think that I should have been some great king, you know, or some great strong man, and here I was, a little willowy, long-haired, 130-pounder, you know, with a stupid cap in my head, you know. So these guys were just such proud denizens of such a great culture coming down to look at the donkey man, you know.
Well, tell us about your journey then. You know, why did you take this up? And how did you do it?
The actual walk?
Yeah. Lizzie? Well, tell our listeners a little bit about the story of your walk. How did you get started? Why did you do it? What was your plan?
Well, I was reading, it was 1978. Now, I'm a married man and still am, and I have a dear wife, Belita. And it was 1978, and it's November now, and I'm reading The Hobbit. And I was becoming very restless. And I said to Belita, I need to take a walk. And she said, fine, Kevin, we're not going to eat for another hour or two. And I said, no, Belita, I really need to take a walk. And my idea was to walk Ireland, you know, as much of it as I could and come home and maybe someday write an Irish children's story. Ireland's Heidi. That's what was in my mind. Well, Belita was fine with it in certain ways because she's from the Philippine Islands and her family was in California, and she'd love a year with her family, and I'd love a year with my family. So that was set and done. When I told Belita, meet me back at Radigan's pub on Christmas Eve, and I'll be the best husband and a great father. Bingo. So I was off on my own for a year. But I did not know I was going to walk the donkey when I got there. I thought I'd just maybe hop on a bike or just live in the villages or go from place to place. But there was in 79, there was a postal strike that lasted 5 months in Ireland. And then there was this OPEC oil crisis. And then there was the Northern Troubles, and it was a tinderbox there. And then the Pope was making his historical visit to Ireland in 79. And during all of this, I was very homesick for home, you know, for America, and I had very little money. And I was pedaling a bike to my grandmother's house in Roscommon when I saw a little donkey being tipped along by a farmer in a cart. And I says, oh, my God, I said, that's the way of traveling Ireland, the old way. Of course, when I brought it up to the old men at Radigan's Bar, where I used to go in the evenings and have the occasional pint, they just thought I had lost my mind. There was one old man named Hugh Mannion who said, you're thinking about walking an ass around Ireland. I have two at home that won't cross Darren Bog. You know, and Darren Bog was probably 2 miles in length. It was the perfect thing to do. Because I hit the heartstrings and the reminiscences of all the old folks who had worked with donkeys in their youth, and even into their middle age.
Well, now, you had never worked with a donkey or driven a donkey before, had you?
No, and nor was I ever going to drive a donkey because she wouldn't move when I get up on the car. That's why I decided to walk her along.
And she walked at a fairly easygoing pace.
Yeah, about 8 miles a day. As I say in the book, she walked 3 times slower than a fat caddy in July. and that is tremendously slow. We'll say uphill most of the time too.
Well, you came in for a fair amount of ribbing because you walked beside her.
And oh, I know.
Tell us why you walked beside her.
Well, there were a couple of reasons. One, I wanted to befriend her. I wanted to know her as a little, not as a beast of burden, but more or less a pair. Because the great concern at Radigan's and why most people put their wagers against me and Missy returning back to Radigan's Pub by Christmas Eve was because they never thought one donkey, especially a mare donkey, could do it because she would lose heart. And I said, how can a mare donkey lose heart? Well, they told me that they were always home at night. Whatever their chore was, they'd always be back to the same shed or byre in the evening. And this donkey wouldn't have that. And they wanted me to take a jack around like a jackass. Mm-hmm. So I didn't want two jackasses parading around Ireland, me and the other one. And I fell in love with this little mare donkey because she was a lovely little color. And she did depart. But I decided then to walk beside her. And not only that, but there was traffic on the road. And air brakes would really frighten her, and she'd jump. Anything made in a foundry, like manhole covers, she would go around the side of the road or towards the middle of the road. Oil slicks in the road, which also make her get spooky, and also like blown newspaper or plastic. So it was better to just kind of stay side by side with her. But the only thing is, every time I did get up on the cart to kind of tip her along, she turned her head. She wouldn't move for me. I could not for the life of me get her to tip along. She wanted me by her side for whatever particular reason. I could not get up on the cart and tip her along like the great horseman could, Jimmy McDermott. And then the old men, wherever I'd be, would ask, why don't you get up on the cart and tip her along? Walking an ass around Ireland is like hailing a taxi in the city and then to go home running behind it. That's what they say to me.
Now, we should tell our listeners that tip means to...
Just walk. Oh, yeah, I could kind of run her along into a little gallop, you know, a little prance.
Oh, I see.
Again, with the prance, it could also, you know, she could pull a muscle or she could go a little limp or lame. So why bother? Why risk it? And we only needed to go 8 to 10 miles a day to cover the 1,700 miles in the 8 months that we had. So I didn't want to rush it. And not only that, but to gallop down the road, you'd miss the people at the gates that were more or less waiting for you.
And I noticed that she becomes more of a personality as the book progresses. Is this because she became that way for you as time went on?
Oh, very much. Robert Louis Stevenson in 1878 wrote a book about his travels in the Cevennes in France. And he said after 110 miles and 12 days, he returned the donkey back to the market square and sold the donkey back. The donkey's name was Modestine. And he said he openly wept at that time. Well, after 110 miles and 12 days with my dear Missy, I would have gladly shot her with a smile on my face. We had a very difficult time coming to grips with one another. She would often bite me in the fat of the leg. I was... not cruel, but I often used the hazel stick in the early going. And then about 300 or 400 miles into the journey, we had an incident at O'Neill's camp where a big warble fly landed on her back, and I swatted it with my hazel stick and killed it. But Missy didn't know what the strike was for, and she bit me in the leg again, and I fell to the ground. I stood up. I raised my stick to give her a good clout, and I said, no more. I'm never going to strike this beast again. And it seemed like at that particular point, for some unknown reason, we never had a squabble again, and off we went.
Wow.
Yeah. Figure that out. Talk to your animal psychologist about that one.
Well, now,
but each time I raised the stick, even in the early going, I didn't like it. And I think I put in the story, it just sent... like a little, some bad will into the world, some mm-hmm. bad karma, something with the lashing of a stick to a donkey's back just was not right, and it didn't suit the journey itself. And again, that's how magical the journey became for me. It was seamless in certain ways. It was wrinkle-free, you know. Everything that happened seemingly happened for a great reason. When I was down to a couple of pounds in my pocket, somebody gave me a fiver. when I was down to a handful of oats that Missy needed every day, somebody would stop and give me a bag. But it was like that all the way around the coast.
And you almost gave up in the beginning.
Oh, yeah. The beginning was the hardest. The first 2 weeks on the road were the toughest.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, when you came to the end of your journey and Missy came home, did she recognize her old home?
Oh, yes. Oh, very much so. Jimmy McDermott met me as we made our turn at Carnmore Cross, which is it's in Galway, 40 miles from Radigan's. But we took the same road in and out to get to the coast. Missy and I had traveled 1,660 miles at that time. And I gave her a big apple because that's where our circle ended or was clasped. And then for the next 5 or 6, 10 miles, her pace was just quicker and brighter because she had been dragging. And then that continued right to Radigan's Pub. Actually, about a mile before Radigan's Pub, she really started to gas out, which is another strange little thing. But she had 7 or 8 days of the brightest little step. And when Jimmy McDermott, the horseman who actually, I purchased the donkey from, when I told him about it, he says, oh, she knows she's home. And I knew that for a fact because they know the roads that they had traveled, because we had to go up to Belmullet, which is in the far west, north and west extremity of Ireland, because I wanted to touch that corner. But to get to Belmullet, we had to take the same road out and the same road back. And I tell you, she was in ill humor the whole 5 miles back to the main road. Yeah, so she knew the roads she traveled.
Well, no, you didn't have to sell her at the end.
Well, she was auctioned off for charity. I didn't know what to do with her. We were headed home to America, Belita and I, to start a family for me to try to settle down everything. I remember landing in New York and having to catch a subway on an evening when that morning I had walked Missy for the last time from my grandmother's to my aunt's where she stayed. But then she was auctioned off for charity on the Late Late Show in Ireland. And she fetched a good price. She went to a wonderful family in Cork. But 7 years later, Belita and I and our two boys, Eamon and Brendan, they were ages 6 and 3 at the time, we went back to Ireland, and we were able to find Missy McDermott after a 3-month search because she had fallen into bad hands, and we purchased her back for £55, though I had £500 in my pocket.
Wow.
Yeah.
Now, you saved her from certain death. In fact, every other donkey that she was with when you were looking at a passel of donkeys, I don't know if that's the right expression, looking at a group of donkeys to see which one you'd buy, all the others met a very untimely end. Is that what would have happened to her?
Yeah, I think it may have, although she was, she was a head above the others that he had collected, so he may have tried to sell her to another farmer. But of the 11 donkeys that Jimmy McDermott corralled for me to choose from, the 9 that were non-contenders were put into a horse cart and taken away to be dog food.
And is that the fate of most donkeys?
It had been, very much so. And in fact, it got terrifically horrific there. But now there's been a great thing. There's a donkey sanctuary in Cork. There's another one in England. Actually, there's one here in California, too, to save the burros out in the west. But the donkeys were actually disappearing from the land. And, they're kind of like a great symbol of Ireland. Yeah, even the Phoenix Park Zoo was going around collecting donkeys in the 80s. In fact, that was what I thought may have happened to Missy when we couldn't find her right away. Phoenix Park Zoo was coming around and giving 10, 15, 20 pounds to farmers who had old, donkeys in the field because they'd use them for the animals in the zoo, feed the lions there. Yeah.
So zoos were not collecting them to save them, but to use them for donkey meat.
Yeah.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Kevin O'Hara about his memoir, Last of the Donkey Pilgrims. There's a lot of wonderful detail in the book about all kinds of Irish traditions, the wee folk and folk superstitions, as well as religiosity that mingles with the pagan. You know, the pagan and the Christian really mingle. It's all very much an evidence of, you know, you're sprinkled with holy water. There are, people are giving you rituals and good luck charms all the time. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that and how you related to that.
Holy wells. I mean, my mother sprinkled me. Well, if you might recall in the book, my mother, my grandmother made me go to Knox Shrine before I set off on a journey. And that's a very famous place in Ireland. It's like the Lords of the Fatima of Ireland. And she had me carry a small little bottle of holy water. And she certainly sprinkled a fair amount of it on my donkey and me before we set out. But then in May, May 1st, you may recall in the book how I took a handkerchief to the ground to pick up the May Dew on Mary's morning, or May Day.
Yes.
On the 1st, and how I had gotten so little of it, you know, about half a dram, and my hands were frozen. And that's when Tom Nolan came onto the scene. And he said, if you're thinking about collecting holy water, which is, they see it upon as Mary's water on that day, you should come up with me. And he was the one who cut me the stick of hazel. And the hazel, he felt, had as much charm and power as the holy water. And every now and again, I would find things like that. I travel on the road. There was I have a photograph of it, of a cross, a lovely cross etched into a barn, a small shed, with a horseshoe right on top of it. So it almost playing with the two deities. But the hazel stick and the rosary beads, I carried rosary beads with me, and I used to dip them in every well. And whether they were pagan wells, of course, they were all sanctified by the saints, supposedly. But some of these offerings were very archaic. There's many of these little ribbon bushes where people will dig old coins, put old coins into the bark of a tree, or tie little pieces of ribbon that may have something to do with their clothes. If they're concerned or they need a cure. When you see these little things in the landscape, they are tremendously pagan-looking. And then you'll see the little holy well underneath, and which now may be called St. Kieran's. But, you know, a couple of hundred years ago, I'm sure that certainly wasn't the name.
And could you tell us what a hazel stick, what it signifies? Why would it have power?
Hazel stick was, as this man, Tom Nolan, who cut it for me, there's nine woods in Ireland, nine particular woods. They all seemingly have great power. And the hazel is, Queen Maeve was a great mythological, probably queen of Ireland. And she had once said that she could walk all of Ireland armed only with a hazel stick. It's also, a hazel stick is also used for diviners when they're looking for wells. It's the hazel stick they use for that. If you want to ask me that question, I'll just read you a piece of what Tom Nolan told me.
That'd be great.
That'd be wonderful. Tom Nolan seems representative of many of the wonderful people you met who had...
Yeah, I mean, and not only that, but, you know, when I was saying the good things, I've been into many of these pubs where terrific things happened to me on the night of my walk with the donkey, and I've been to those pubs many times since, and nothing's going on, you know?
Wow.
And it wasn't me. I just caught these places at a great time. You know, which again was pure luck, huh?
Or you came with a hazel stick and some holy water.
Yeah, exactly.
Had your hazel stick with you.
Exactly. Well, you're right. I mean, you don't know. And I think it was a one-time only thing. Yes, let me see. I haven't really... You want me to...
Yeah, you can just go ahead and read it.
All right.
Great.
Okay. Well, next morning, the 1st of May, as the villagers along the western seaboard hung sprigs of hawthorn called maybows on their doors to keep out trooping fairies, I began to collect the morning dew by soaking a handkerchief and wringing it into a small bottle. There's great power in dew gathered on Mary's morning, my grandmother had instructed me, passing along the small collection kit before my departure. Sprinkle it on yourself and your donkey to protect you from the wrongdoers of the road. So as I'm doing this, Tom Nolan comes by, and he just can't believe what I'm doing. And he says, "Is it a kettle of water you're after?" shouted Tom Nolan, scaring the life out of me. "No," I came to and called back. "It's holy water." I raised the bottle with its few precious drops. Tom did not blink at the absurdity, but had a suggestion of his own. "You'll need a stick of hazel along with that holy water. Faith in the deity is one matter, but fairies in the other world are quite another. So was Maeve herself, queen of all Connaught, who said she could walk the world armed only with a switch of hazel. And for all the fairy haunts you're likely to stumble upon, you'd be a foolish man to ever let the hazel out of your grasp. Follow me to Hudgens Grove on the summit of a Tyculio Kelly, he beckoned me with a rallying cry, and there I'll cut you a stick of hazel. At first I thought Tom might be having me on, but as we climbed a hillside path with the last view of Slieve Bawn to the east, I realized he truly believed in the power of hazel. There are skeptics who believe the charms of the hazel are just a pishogue, a Celtic superstition, said Tom, disappearing into a white flowering thicket with a sharp knife. But my father, God be good to him, was a man of honor, and many a night he come home with his knees poking out of torn trousers and telling my mother, God be good to her, how the confounded wee folk had tied up his bootlaces, and it was only his stick of hazel that saved him from the other world. Well, you know what, I'm reading this now, and I don't know if that's really the piece I'm really looking for.
Well, that's wonderful, too, so we want to keep that in. If you find the other one, that's fine also.
Sorry. And I got I have glasses that aren't my own, and they're falling out down my nose. Nothing ever runs right. No, I'm just trying to look for me. I'm a flipping madman. Well, I found that little mystical hazel thing.
Oh, good.
Oh, great.
Yeah, this is where I hit, you know, Missy with the hoof. I mean, I saved her with the warble flies, and she bit me then, and then I never struck her again after that. But anyways, this is what I say. Mystical hazel, I proclaimed, standing it upright to wipe it clean in the grass. Sacred tree of August, Queen Maeve's walking stick, wooden wand of kings, divining rod for holy wells, staff of faith. No one needs to convince me of your royal and bewitching powers after all these miles of road. I dub you Ty O'Kelly for the noble hill from whence you came.
That's wonderful.
Yeah,
that's
and then great. The stick broke after 1,500 miles, and it killed me. I mean, mm-hmm. You know, people who smoke cigarettes, they always say, I don't know what to do with my hands.
Mm-hmm.
And you say, why? I mean, you have to do something with your hands, whether you got a cigarette in or not. But I felt that way with the hazel stick.
Mm-hmm.
And when it broke, it just broke in the road because I kept golfing stones. It was a wonderful little weapon to have. Sheepdogs were a misery to us on the road because they'd oftentimes come out and snip at Missy's heels. And I always had to more or less protect Missy. And the stick, all I had to do was raise it because I really became fearless with it because I started to believe in its power. And where it broke was another odd oddity of the journey. It broke at Duloc in County Mayo, the Black Lake, where during the height of the famine, 400 villagers had perished. They had gone about 6 miles to a place called Delphi, hoping for food that supposedly had arrived there, and it did not arrive, and they were coming back home. A snowstorm came through the valley, and they all perished there, and this is where my stick broke. And, you know, it was just, again, Ireland is just so, I mean, everything is just so, it's so thick with everything, and clouds and weather, that it seemed real. You could almost see the ghosts coming off the fogs in the mountain, you know. And 2 days later, so I'm without a hazel stick. 2 days later, I'm going through Lennon in County Galway, and there's a great old man there with 10 or 12 kids, and he's telling them stories. And they just got out of school, and no child is in a rush to leave him. And he says, where is your stick? Broken over her back, was it? And I said, no. I said, it just broke down the way. And he handed me his stick, which was a holly stick. A beautiful stick. And he said, here, take that for the rest of your travels. In the chapter, I call it Hazel to Holly. To me, it just symbolized every time I needed something, it was just around the bend. That's why I had to write the journey, you know, the book.
It was a good journey. It was a life journey.
And it was a magical journey. Very, very much the kind of magic that seems very fitting with Ireland. And the book is The Last of the Donkey Pilgrims. And were you really the last? Nobody ever came after you?
No, I think traffic would. If I even wanted to try it again, I think you'd be flattened on the road and there'd be no comfort.
Well, we're much richer for the fact that you did make that journey.
Oh, well, thanks so much, you too.
Thank you for talking with us, Kevin O'Hara.
Well, thank you.
Thanks for joining us this week for Writer's Voice. Please tune in next week when we talk to Ann Jones, author of Women Who Kill, about her searing new book, Kabul in Winter. We'll also talk with Brant Goldstein about his book, Storming the Court, How a Band of Yale Law Students Sued the President and Won. Until then, I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon, and Writer's Voice will go out today on the wings of Irish music.